Yeah, tell us about the pig market.
So pigs, for example, if you want to sell pork into Japan, you have to sell it differently than you do in the United States. So it has to be free of antibiotics, free of growth hormones. It has to be inspected by Japanese inspectors. It has to be made a certain way. They've invested a tremendous amount now in certain processing plants that will meet Japanese requirements ahead of the TPP coming into force. Now many of those farmers are suddenly looking at all of that production and saying, well, what was the point of that? Because we are about to be undercut substantially in price by pigs coming in from all of these other TPP countries. We may be sitting on extremely expensive investments that we've made that we can't sell in Japan, and we can't sell profitably anywhere else.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. And yes, I've got a cold this week, a bad one. That's what happens on a 16-hour direct flight from Singapore to San Francisco, made worse by the fact that I was seated next to an 11-year-old boy in transit from New Delhi. Nice kid, but a bad cough. But we press on. I might be encumbered with a bad cold, but that's nothing compared to the chilly reception the Americans are receiving in Asia-Pacific trade circles. I'm talking about the TPP, the embattled Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement. You are listening to the voice of Deb Elms at the start of the show. She's founder and executive director of the Asia Trade Center in Singapore. Deb is talking about one of the most conspicuously underreported repercussions of the U.S. withdrawal from the TPP and its impact on the American farmer. It's probably not a story you've heard, and it's indicative of the unforeseen consequences of Trump's decision to turn his back on the agreement. She's joined this episode by another trade advocate, Steve Okun, who Inside Asia listeners might remember from a previous episode on impact investing and the story of East Bali cashews. You can find it along with all our earlier episodes at www.insideasiapodcast.com. Steve's on the board of governors of the American Chamber of Commerce in Singapore, which was, under Okun's leadership, the first business association to endorse the TPP. Shortly thereafter, President Obama announced that the U.S. would be party to it. That was before the election of Trump. On his first day in office, Trump announced that he would issue an intent to withdraw from the TPP, an agreement which he said would be, quote, a potential disaster for our country. For a lot of Americans, that made a lot of sense. In fact, it was a thing that got him elected in the first place. Trump seemed to regard it as a privilege to do business with the U.S., and the TPP dissolution was a chance to put the art of the deal into practice. The idea that bilateral agreements are, according to the deal master himself, a much better option for the U.S. than multilateral agreements sits at the heart of Trump's approach to, well, just about everything. That's my first question to Deb and Steve. Where does this notion that multilateral deals are somehow inferior come from? And is it true that bilateral deals are always better for the U.S.?
So there's two parts to that question. First, why is the United States such a desirable place to trade? Because he views the United States as the world's largest market, and therefore you, the counterparty, will do whatever it takes to get access to the world's largest market. Now, the problem with that assumption, from my perspective, is that the U.S. market is relatively open. So most counterparties already have quite good access to the U.S. market. And that makes it a bit less interesting as a counterparty, just generally. That's not to say that people aren't interested in doing an agreement with the United States. They are. But the requirements to do an agreement with the United States are also quite onerous. And they're especially onerous on the counterparty. So it's not that the United States is giving you unprecedented access. It's that the United States asks you to do a lot of very challenging, difficult reforms domestically in order to get better access to the United States. That's a tough bargain for counterparties to agree to.
And that's not the impression a lot of people have. A lot of people play it, at least politically, like the U.S. market is entirely open, free access, free, and yet there's restrictions against U.S. businesses operating overseas.
No, there are some barriers to doing access in the United States still. And in order to remove those last barriers, the demands on the other side is quite extensive. So if you are going to do a bilateral agreement, it's very challenging because the counterparty has to do a lot of reforms in exchange for access to one market. That's tough because for companies, it is a rare company that only operates in two places, their own home market and one other market. Even the United States, which is the world's largest market, is desirable, yes, But to do things in this globalized economy in just two places is pretty rare. And so bilaterals are increasingly less interesting for companies.
Interesting. And that wasn't always the case then. So for many years, bilaterals during post-World War II might have been effective, but now not so much.
Well, no, I mean, there's still a time and place for bilaterals. But there's also, because of all the reasons Deb just said, a time and place for multi-party agreements, be they multilateral agreements or plurilateral agreements. We still want to have bilateral investment treaties between the U.S. and certain countries. I think a U.S.-Indonesia agreement on a bilateral basis makes a lot of sense. A U.S.-China negotiation on a bilateral basis makes a lot of sense.
Why does that make sense?
Because you have different types of abilities between the countries. You have complementary areas. You have areas where U.S. businesses have a great deal of issues in that particular country. It might be foreign direct investment restrictions. It might be competition with state-owned enterprises. And you want to address those on a point-by-point basis. At the same time, for all the reasons Deb said, you also want to have these multi-party agreements like the TPP. So certainly as a business community, as AmCham, we are in favor of bilateral agreements when that makes the most sense, but we don't think that a multi-party agreement is always going to be not in the interest of the U.S. We think, for the reasons Deb said, we think the opposite.
Okay. So multilateral and bilateral agreements can coexist. You just have to be, they're complicated, and you have to make sure they're not conflicting. It requires a lot of input, a lot of resource, a lot of negotiation, but it's possible, and that's in your minds, for both of you, the idea that two can exist and should exist.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think to say one is never desirable or the other is only desirable, I think is a mistake.
And here we're sitting here in Singapore. And in 2014, the U.S. signed a bilateral trade agreement with Singapore.
2004.
Oh, I'm sorry, 2004. You're right. That's right. And there's been a decade of results, and the results are pretty effective. We now, U.S. has a trade surplus. There's been a 50% increase in trade between the two countries. And for all intent and purposes, it looks like a raving success. So is it that perhaps members of the Trump administration look to that and say, you see, it works. And so therefore, why don't we continue down that path? And nobody's complaining about this bilateral agreement, are they?
No, this is an agreement that has been, from the United States perspective and also from Singapore's perspective, viewed as a success. But given the metric that the Trump administration is using to judge trade, which is only merchandise trade in goods and only if it's in surplus viewed from the United States, not every existing bilateral with the United States is a success, because some of them have led to deficits in merchandise trade in goods. The U.S. always, from the Trump administration's perspective, discounts trade and services. Not all of them then are a success viewed by that measure. And I think that is the challenge. It's very hard to always have a surplus in goods trade as a result of any kind of trade, but also as a result of a trade agreement.
Right. And we're living in the 21st century, and services have not been fully accommodated, which is where a multilateral actually lends itself to a better arrangement, a more optimal arrangement.
I think it's, in general, again, I think it's hard for companies to just use a bilateral agreement, especially for services, because services are hard to use between just two countries. They're often plugged in. Their services are a key part of even manufacturing goods. Our research shows that between 30 and 50% of a manufactured good is actually services. So if you don't do a good job of opening up services trade, then you're also missing the key part of a manufacturing product. That's important to deal with. So I think when we only look at the merchandise trade and goods, then we miss something. There's also a slightly technical issue around the way that we measure merchandise trade in goods that the Trump administration keeps missing. So there are a lot of challenges around the way that they measure success. I would argue for different measures of success, and I think we would see different results.
You've both acknowledged that the TPP is not perfect. What are the main flaws, and what, if anything, might be done to satiate the Trump administration in order to resuscitate multilateral negotiations?
I want to go back first to one of the points you made on the U.S.-Singapore FTA and then talk about that. So when you talked about the benefits of the U.S.-Singapore FTA, you talked about the increase in trade and the amount of the surplus. But if you go and read Katie McFarland's testimony, and she is the nominated ambassador for Singapore, she also talked about the fact that the U.S.-Singapore FTA supports 215,000 U.S. jobs. And that's what's critical, and that's what we've been missing in this trade debate. We talk about surpluses, we talk about market access, but we don't talk about the jobs that are created by trade in the U.S. from these FTAs or what would be created from the TPP. And that is what has been missing in this debate. And when it comes to the TPP, we need to bring it back to jobs. We need to bring it. So you say the agreement's not perfect, and we can get into IP protection and what's there and not there and what phase-ins are and all those things that Deb is expert in. But what we need to talk about TPP, which we didn't do enough of in the run-up to the debate in Congress, is the jobs it's going to create in the U.S.
But the focus is all on the jobs that you would lose, those that are being exported out of the United States. People were losing their jobs in the manufacturing, commodities, minerals, mining. You know, these are the areas that people were all worried about, and that was the base. That was the Republican base. So what you're saying is jobs actually are and can and have been created primarily in the services, financial services, internet technologies area, and that hasn't come out as well as it should have.
And in the manufacturing part as well, in the manufacturing base as well. If you look at all of the suppliers that have to supply the exporters like your Caterpillars and your Boeings, and we don't capture that enough. The SMEs in the U.S. who are supporting the exporters they're selling to Peoria or they're selling to Seattle or wherever those products are going. They don't realize that their jobs are being exported. That's the thing that we need to do much better as a business community on is finding those numbers, tracking that, and then talking about jobs. Just as the administration talked about jobs in the hearing to be the ambassador to Singapore.
So who's doing that job? Who's pulling together the data to demonstrate job creation for American organizations, American corporations?
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce did pull together a map that showed some of the jobs attached by district to TPP. The Peterson Institute in the United States in Washington did a nice job of showing jobs that would be affected by TPP if it were to stop. And in particular, one of the things that was interesting about the Peterson numbers was it showed interesting job losses by the end of the TPP, ending the TPP for the United States in odd places. And in particular, it showed very interesting job losses, for example, along the Mississippi River that you would not have thought of as being tied to trade in Asia, for example, but deeply concentrated along the Mississippi Delta area, for example. And I think that was an interesting exercise in sort of modeling why it is that those jobs are so tightly tied to Asia.
Why didn't that research make its way up through the corridors of power during the election and post-election?
Well, I think for Trump himself, one of the reasons why he likes bilaterals and why he dislikes larger agreements is that he fundamentally thinks that bilateral agreements are better because the United States has more power in a bilateral arrangement and they get more of what they want. An agreement with more than two parties, by definition, either means that you don't get as much as you could or the other party gets more than they should. These are, by definition, a bad outcome for the United States.
I see.
It's irrelevant. Who wins, who loses, whatever. It's just that the United States doesn't get all that it could out of a more than two-person, two-party agreement.
And that's his, yeah, please.
Yeah, Steve. No, so just 2 points. I think one, in terms of why didn't those numbers come out? Every trade agreement, you know, I've been, you know, part of the part of trade agreement negotiations and advocacy for years. The problem with trade agreements is the jobs that are going to get lost, you know, the person who is going to lose that job or is likely to lose that job. The gains are much more diffuse. They're spread around the entire country. So it becomes much more difficult to talk about a greater economic benefit that's very, very widely dispersed versus the specific person who's going to lose their job, the factory that's going to get shut down, the sector that's going to leave. So that's always difficult in trade debates. I think what happened in TPP is we got a little bit too far away from the economic debate and talking about the jobs that were going to be created, how the agriculture sector was really going to be a big winner. And then we talked about China. And we talked about how this is U.S. versus China, who's going to set the and create the architecture for trade in the 21st century. Is it going to be a U.S.-based system or is it going to be a Chinese-based system? Workers in the U.S. don't care about that.
Well, let's talk about that. Now, you mentioned that earlier. I mean, what do you feel that so demonizing China was a bad decision? Do you think in many ways that was what put off people? And like you say, they didn't care. What they cared about this highly politicized, targeted, you know, ideas of here's a worker in Iowa who's going to lose his job. Let's focus there. And everybody bought in, right?
And that's most trade. You know, lobbying campaigns are about jobs. You go back to NAFTA and go back, you know, all the way through. It's almost always about jobs is a big reason why you would do it and what the benefits are to the U.S. economy. This became a strategic debate, and you lose in politics when you can't make the case to the voters. And the voters are voting on the economy, you know, and they're not voting on geopolitics and they're not voting on strategy. And so now you're seeing all of these articles coming out saying, oh, well, this is actually what's going to happen now that TPP is no longer there for the U.S., but it's still there.
This is Inside Asia, and my guests are Steve Okun and Deb Elms, and we're talking about the demise of the TPP and the shape of things to come. Before the break, we were talking about the politics of the TPP and how many of the ancillary benefits of a broader trade agreement might have benefited the American economy. In fact, it had the potential of driving a net increase in jobs versus a decline in employment as widely and erroneously suggested by Trump himself. On the one hand, we might say that the implications for the American economy were underreported. On the other hand, you might say it wasn't necessarily in Trump's political interest to weigh the nuances of the TPP membership. Nobody is suggesting that the TPP was an ideal document. There were flaws, and perhaps added rounds of discussion might have resolved many of these issues. I asked Steve and Deb about the problems in the original TPP and what efforts might be made to address these issues in TPP 11, even in the absence of U.S. participation.
There were three key issues that caused a problem for the United States at the end. So one was an issue related to tobacco that was put in largely at the request of the other 11. There was an issue
around...
That's
an interesting one.
It's a bit technical, but basically it carved out tobacco as a specific sector for investor protection.
Mm.
It was put in at the request, especially of Australia, who had had some prior legal cases related to tobacco products. So that caused some problems in tobacco states.
And there it is.
And
there's that
Mitch
base
McConnell.
As well, right?
Yeah. So it's a bit of an issue. It doesn't mean that tobacco wasn't covered in the agreement. It was. It had a lot of other issues. But in terms of investor protection, it was a problem. This was unfixable because of the other 11. The second issue that was a problem had to do with a carve out for financial services data from the e-commerce chapter. Again, these are technical issues. So it's odd. It's an enormous agreement. And at the end of the day, three fairly small, very minor issues are the ones that were tagged with the problems.
This is the domain of e-commerce.
E-commerce, there was an issue related to the whether or not financial services data could be moved.
Mm.
It was an issue put in by U.S. Treasury. It was actually addressed and resolved in the post negotiations, but it was a problem early on, and it meant that the financial services industry didn't come out favorably early when the text was finally released.
Right, so tobacco, financial services, what else?
And the third one had to do with the patent protections on a certain kind of pharmaceutical product.
Mm.
And this related to Orrin Hatch's personal interest. So you hit several key senators, two key senators, and a key lobbying group. And this created enough of a logjam in Congress that the agreement didn't come up for a vote.
A block.
In the middle of a heated political run for office. And
nice. So
that's what stopped the TPP from moving forward at the time.
Excellent, Deb. That's very clear. Very clear. Thanks. A little bit about, you know, the next move by the Trump administration, which are these so-called 301 investigations. Could you tell us a little bit about those, your concerns and their implications?
So the United States is doing two different investigations using two different very old tools in the U.S. toolkit. One is called a 232, which is a very broad national security exemption from the Cold War on steel, which the United States has actually, at the moment, decided not to use for some extended period of time, and we don't know what will happen with that on steel and aluminum. The second is a case that we're expecting potentially next week called 301, which is another very broad tool that the United States used a lot in the 70s and 80s that allows the United States to act unilaterally to impose a range of sanctions against a trading partner if it thinks the trading partner is engaged in unfair trade. The United States wants to use it against China for what it apparently is going to allege is unfair trade on tech transfer for the Chinese firms. This tool, 301, was retired from use when the United States got all of the other parties in the multilateral system in the World Trade Organization to reform the system and make a binding dispute settlement system at the multilateral setting. Because before that, the United States said, well, the reason why we need this really tough tool is because there's no way to hold countries accountable to enforcement. So the U.S. managed to reform the system, retired this tool from use.
Got it.
Now the United States says, nothing is happening. We're going to bring the tool back again and use it.
It's like using a sledgehammer to get a result. It's also prodding and poking and scrapping for a fight to some degree. You start to bring this out, and other countries are going to stand up and say, well, if you're willing to play that way, I have a few gripes of my own, and now you get mired. Is that a concern?
I think it's a deeply alarming tool because of the potential implications for a trade dispute with China, number one. Number two, the implications on the trading system. If the United States can do this unilateral enforcement tool, then other countries will want to do the same thing. And then you see a breakdown in discipline across the trading system. Both of these, I think, is alarming.
Once again, it's going back to, an old model of governing, something that worked maybe post-Cold War, but may not be apropos for a different, more, flattened and more genuine multilateral means of engagement in the world today.
I think it's deeply problematic. I mean, it's partly a challenge because the global trading system itself has been stuck. Hmm. And we haven't had a new set of trading rules since 1995. And so that's part of the challenge, and I understand that. And I understand the increasing unhappiness by U.S. companies in particular with what they see as an unfair trade system vis-a-vis China for a variety of reasons. But it does create, this particular tool is also problematic. So I think in reaching for this tool as the sledgehammer to use to solve this problem or set of problems, we may be setting ourselves up for bigger challenges in the future.
Steve, what's the view from the multinational community out here? I mean, are they concerned about this as well, or do they say, okay, it's overdue? Yeah, let's go in and have a scrap.
Well, I mean, you had a whole podcast with our friend, Jim McGregor on this a few weeks ago. The technology transfer issue is a real issue for U.S. business. It's an issue of serious concern. It's been raised many times. It's been, there was a New York Times article by Dave Barbosa on Qualcomm on this entire issue of tech transfers. So it is something that the business community wants to get addressed. How you get addressed is very difficult. I mean, Jim talked about the need for reciprocity, and how do you do reciprocity between the U.S. and China when it comes to technology transfers? Is 301 the right tool for it is a different question. Now, so we're certainly supportive of action by the U.S. government to try to get to some reciprocal arrangement when it comes to technology to make sure that we don't have to do these types of things that are being complained about. But at the same time, it's concern if you use 301, are you now blowing up the entire WTO system down the road? So where all of this comes out, we don't know. No 301 complaint has been initiated. Even if one is initiated, it doesn't mean that you're going to get to an end where the U.S. will take sanctions against China. So it's too early to be going down the road saying this is going to blow up the trading system, but it is something that needs to get addressed.
This is Inside Asia, and when we come back, a story that is being almost entirely overlooked by the mainstream media about what the U.S. removal of itself from the TPP means for American farmers. You're not going to want to miss this. This is Steve Stein, and my guests are Steve Okin and Deb Elms. We're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and the consequences of the U.S. withdrawal from the deal. Trump called it a bad deal for America. But it turns out that not being involved is a bad deal for American farmers. As the dust settles on Trump's rejection of the pact, we discover that U.S. agriculture may feel the biggest pinch. All the more ironic considering the support that Trump received from the Farm Belt during the election. What is the impact of the TPP rejection on Middle America? And how bad could it get, especially for farmers in places like Iowa?
When the Trump administration pulled out of TPP, I think the assumption was that TPP in particular was now dead. It was not going to go forward. And I think that the farming community especially is going to be deeply damaged when TPP 11 moves forward in November.
And TPP 11, can you explain that?
That is the other 11 parties in the TPP and the crucial problem for farming.
And they're moving forward,
by the
way.
They are moving forward, and we expect to have the agreement, I assume, will be launched in November. We'll see, fingers crossed, but I assume it will be launched in November to take effect probably at the beginning of 2019, probably January of 2019. But again, it's not yet set, so we're not sure. But when that happens, it will be impossible for farmers in Iowa in particular, but pick any agricultural sector, to take advantage of the TPP 11. And the key market for them is Japan. Because the access into Japan for TPP 11 countries is unprecedented. The Japanese have never opened their agricultural market this far in any existing agreement. And that opens up the Japanese agricultural sector for very important agricultural producers like the Australians, the New Zealanders, the Canadians, to sell into the Japanese market. That is an extraordinarily lucrative market where the United States farm community has been traditionally making important advances. Now, why does this matter? Well, one of the reasons that it matters is that if you want to sell into the Japanese market, you have to do a lot of complicated things to the produce or the products that you want to sell in order to be eligible for standards reasons to sell.
Yeah, tell us about the pig market.
So pigs, for example, if you want to sell pork into Japan, you have to sell it differently than you do in the United States. So it has to be free of antibiotics, free of growth hormones. It has to be inspected by Japanese inspectors. It has to be made a certain way.
And investments have already been made by U.S. farmers.
Investments have already been made in growing those pigs from, you know, birth onward. They've invested a tremendous amount now in certain processing plants that will meet Japanese requirements ahead of the TPP coming into force. Now many of those farmers are suddenly looking at all of that production and saying, well, what was the point of that? Because we are about to be undercut substantially in price by pigs coming in from all of these other TPP countries. We may be sitting on extremely expensive investments that we've made that we can't sell in Japan, and we can't sell profitably anywhere else because no one else will pay a premium price for these pork products anywhere else.
Unless you develop a marketing campaign on saying you too can eat Japanese-style pork.
Japanese-style pork, you know? Which no one else cares about really because they don't understand the difference.
Yeah.
And so these farmers who have already, they're already skating on very thin margins, are looking at very substantial investments that they're never going to recoup.
Quantify it for us. What are we talking about? The U.S. agriculture sector and its potential losses by virtue of not being party to TPP?
It could be in the millions. I mean, for example, we're talking about potentially, so $2 a pound differential in price or tariff levels that go from 38% down to zero in different markets. I mean, these are substantial cost reductions, and some of them take effect immediately. And it's not just into Japan. For example, Vietnam, which has 80 million consumers, the Vietnamese tariffs, which are quite high on agriculture, most of those get removed to zero within 3 to 4 years.
Under TPP.
So when the TPP comes into force, agricultural producers across the other TPP countries will suddenly have access to 80 to 90 million consumers at a substantial price difference to U.S. producers. That is huge. And once you start sourcing from New Zealand or Australia, you're unlikely to switch in the future, even if the United States comes back into the TPP.
And what we thought, to bring it back a bit, what we thought when the TPP was being created, one of the premises was that the U.S. is going to get access to fast-growing markets like Vietnam and like Malaysia and get increased access to Japan. And in exchange, Malaysia, Vietnam will get greater access to the U.S. And they will have to, though, undergo pretty significant reforms to their economies when it comes to government procurement, when it comes to labor, when it comes to the environment. So those were all the trade-offs. When the U.S. pulled out of TPP, everyone kind of thought, well, TPP will go away because the premise was you're making these painful reforms to get access to the U.S. domestic market. But it turns out that that's not the case, and that TPP 11 can still go forward for three reasons. One reason is that they're still going to get access to Japan. They're going to get access to Australia. The Japanese are going to get access to Vietnam, and the Aussies are going to get access to Malaysia. So you're still going to have all those inter-trade benefits of having an 11-party plurilateral. So that's one. Two, on the downside protection, countries like Malaysia and Vietnam know they need to liberalize. And this is going to force them to do what they need to do. And they may not be able to do it on their own for their own domestic political reasons, but this will enable them to do that.
And incentivize them.
Yeah, incentivize them to do what they should be doing because they get the upside of the 11. And then the third piece, which is part of the reason why the U.S. wanted to do this, a strategic piece, is how are we going to set the ground rules for free trade in the 21st century? Are we going to include things like IPR protection? Are we going to include things like having a level playing field with state-owned enterprises? Or are we just going to be focused on tariff reductions? So the 11 said, even without the U.S., we want to go forward.
And this is the biggest single mystery to me is that for some reason when Trump walked away from this, he must have thought the world's going to stop and wait for me to make up my mind. But no, 27 different kind of bilateral, multilateral agreements are in play and have been in play, Steve, as you pointed out. You know, this is something that's not going to stop. Deals are being done and Trump is not in the game. What are the implications of that?
The U.S. isn't in the game. And let's not forget that Hillary Clinton also ran against TPP.
Right.
Both major parties ran against TPP. TPP was not going to get signed under Trump or under Clinton, certainly right away.
Because people didn't see, they didn't get, because it was too politically charged.
It was too politically charged, and the business community did not do a good enough job of educating people why it was in their economic interest in the U.S. to vote for this. So blame goes to everybody on this. It goes to both parties, it goes to both candidates, it goes to both of their campaigns, and it goes to the business community. We're going to have to change that, and we're going to work on changing that now. But in the meantime, people out here don't care about Washington's calendar. They care about their own calendar, and TPP 11 is going to happen, and the U.S. business community out here needs to figure out how can we not be completely left out when it comes to TPP 11.
It doesn't sound hopeful, Steve, from the way you'd say it. I mean, because, again, it's such a political football, and if both parties aren't behind it, and if there are these issues that are getting technical issues in the way, we're going to get left behind is the message here.
Certainly, ag is going to get left behind. You cannot raise American cattle in Australia or in Singapore to sell to Japan.
Right.
You can't grow U.S. corn overseas to get into the Japanese market. SMEs are going to lose out because they're not going to be able to shift their supply chains to be within that 11. They're too small and they can't take advantage of it. Will U.S. multinationals be able, through their foreign entities, to be part of the TPP 11 if they keep all of their supply chains within the TPP 11? That's an open question. So the large U.S. companies who are overseas now may not lose out nearly as much as everybody
else. Those with legal presence in the markets that are part of the TPP 11.
It's not about where you're headquartered. It's not about where you pay taxes. It's about what is it that you do?
Okay.
Where do you do it? Where do you sell into? So many of the bigger companies will be able to use TPP 11, again, depending on what they do and where they do it. So ironically enough, I would argue pulling out of the TPP has accelerated offshoring for many companies. Because if you want to take advantage of TPP benefits, depending on what it is you do, you need to be in TPP 11 markets. And if you are in a TPP 11 market and you are selling to a TPP 11 market, the benefits for you are tremendous.
And there are alternatives to TPP. There's the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is China's initiative.
ASEAN's initiative. So 16 countries here in Asia, all 10 countries in ASEAN, China, Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and India, currently under negotiation, probably going to take all of next year to continue to negotiate. It is not the TPP. It will not be TPP quality, but it does have benefits across 16 countries here in Asia. It will cover goods, services, investment, intellectual property rights, e-commerce. There will be a little bit on standards. It's important, and it will open up Asian markets to one another in a way that we haven't seen before. And again, I would argue for U.S. companies who are in Asia serving the Asian markets, you need to be in Asia.
So it's just another device, another trade agreement, which is going to help to perpetuate open, fair access markets, free trade.
Yes, okay. In Asia for Asians.
Okay.
Or companies that are located in Asia.
Yeah.
Yes, the benefits of being in Asia for Asia is fantastic.
What are the implications of China filling the gap and with the withdrawal of the U.S. from TPP? What are the political, social, economic implications of that?
I think that the Chinese are, rhetorically, they've done a fantastic job. The speech that Xi gave at Davos was magnificent. He did a great job of picking up the mantle of pushing globalization and free trade. The practical implications on the ground have been a little less visible. The key counterweight, I would say, has really been Belt and Road, China's, which is truly China's initiative to spread not so much trade, but sort of economic weight in the region. So the Belt and Road Initiative is China's effort to do infrastructure in particular. Their trade initiatives are less obvious. They are not driving the RCEP process, the 16-party agreement. That's really led by ASEAN. China is participating, but they're not driving it. They're not yet driving trade agreements, although they are very active in signing them. They just signed one with Australia. They're very active with other countries here. They signed one with Korea. They are signing with New Zealand. So there are a lot of agreements going on in this region that are hooking up with China.
And what does that say with respect to China's leadership role? I mean, how much influence have they gained as a result of the U.S. backing away?
I think the focus cannot be on China and should not be on China. And that's not where the U.S. businesses are going to lose out the most. It's when people come to Singapore, they say, let's not talk about China. Let's talk about Australia. Australia has more FTAs in the region than the United States does. Let's talk about what Japan is trying to do in its leadership with TPP-11. Let's talk about the EU, which now has an FTA with Vietnam. And is the EU going to do their version of the TPP while the U.S. does not? And so trade is moving forward. People want it to liberalize. They want the 21st century issues addressed that aren't addressed nearly as much in the RCEP as they are in the TPP. That's where the real challenges are coming. Yes, there is obviously a hugely important, you know, strategic relationship between the U.S. and China and how that is going to play out here. But don't take your eye off the ball of everything else that is going on out here. That is a mistake that people are making when it comes to what's going to happen to trade in this region.
You were arguing that, in fact, that's what threw it to begin with, the over-focus on China. And you're saying there's a lot going on in the region among other important trading partners, Japan, Australia, emerging Malaysia, Vietnam. And you're saying it just hasn't received the attention it deserved.
Well, going back, I don't know if TPP would have passed had the lobbying campaign been more focused on jobs and less on China. I mean, it might have been too little too late. We certainly know it didn't pass with the strong emphasis on this is a US v China vote when it came to TPP. But when it's coming to what's going on the ground out here from a business perspective, everybody is moving forward, and they're moving forward as ASEAN, they're moving forward as the TPP-11, they're moving forward with the EU, they're moving forward with each other bilaterally without China. And that's what we need to understand is happening in Washington as we craft what our trade agenda is going to be.
Best case scenario in the next 2 to 3 years, what would you hope for in terms of the types of order of deals that are done, the role that the U.S. plays? What would you hope for?
Out of Washington?
out of in terms of just the kind of combination of bilateral, multilateral agreements, you know, maybe it is just a political decision. I mean, which is it the reentry of the U.S. that would be the best case scenario? Is it, you know, frankly, whether they do or don't, it doesn't matter. It's business as usual. Things are moving forward. Just from a trade perspective, what would you like to see happen in the next 12 to 24 months?
It would be great if we had no trade wars. That would be fantastic.
Right.
That's one.
Yes, that's the best case scenario.
That's the best case scenario.
Yeah.
It would be nice if the United States would re-engage at the multilateral level. That would be fantastic, because one of the challenges that we are clearly seeing, and one of the reasons behind this resurgence of regional and bilateral agreements, I think, is because we are stuck at the global level. Now, that doesn't matter so much for many countries that are engaged in that process, but not everyone is an attractive dance partner for doing these trade agreements. And it would be nice if we had a functioning, effective, global level agreement. It's much better for businesses if we have a global agreement. For example, it makes no sense to do agreements on e-commerce at the bilateral level or regional level. We really need a global agreement, but we can't even get a global agreement to have a discussion about e-commerce right now. So that kind of thing would be crucial. And having the U.S. decide to engage would be fantastic. Right now, the U.S. decision on WTO, the World Trade Organization, is unclear. So having a U.S. engagement at the WTO would be fantastic, especially between now and the next meeting at the end of this year, would be great in the next 12 to 24 months. And having the United States start to create a proactive agenda would be great, besides just being in a defensive crouch.
Yeah. Okay. And Steve, in terms of the, please.
That question is something that we're grappling with right now, certainly as an organization, as AmCham Singapore. You know, we brought the TPP task force back together as TPP 11 is moving forward to figure out what role should the U.S. business community out here play if TPP 11 happens. How do we engage? Because we can't, you know, go to USTR. We can't go to the U.S. embassy because they're not part of the negotiations. So what is it that we're going to do? That is something that we're exploring right now. Deb's a little bit more optimistic than I am that TPP 11 will get done in November. But certainly, if it gets done in November, what is that going to mean for the U.S. business community? That is, we're ground zero here in Singapore to try and figure that out and how we can be involved.
Well, particularly on the back of your earlier comment around the fact that the emphasis was placed on the wrong issues, and a result it failed. Right, there was a politicization of the whole thing. It would be more important than ever before to get focused and targeted on those issues which have the greatest upside for the greatest number of companies, organizations. So I think there is work to be done, because somebody's got to focus this conversation in the right areas in a short period of time. Otherwise, we're going to miss out altogether, it seems to me.
Well, I think lots of people did. When Deb and I, you know, co-wrote an op-ed, I think it was in August of last year, saying, you know, we need to be part of the TPP. The U.S. needs to be part of the TPP. Trade is moving forward here with or without the U.S. Liberalization is happening here with or without the U.S. And that was all theoretical. Now, as it's happening, and as markets are going to close to the U.S. and open to others, you're going to get the articles that talk about the impact on agriculture, on the impact on SMEs. And that's what's going to change the debate, I think, in Washington. So we don't need to retool a lobbying campaign, because reality is going to become front and center that everybody's going to be dealing with.
Steve, Deb, thank you for fighting the good fight. I appreciate your time today, and we'll check back with you in a few months to see if we've made any progress and if that best case scenario actually came to fruition.
Thank you.
That was my interview with Steve Okun from the Board of Governors of the American Chamber of Commerce in Singapore, and Deb Elms, founder and executive director of the Asian Trade Center in Singapore. As listeners know, I like to end each episode with a bungkus. In culinary terms, it means a tasty, traditional takeaway meal of Indonesian-style fried rice. A broader translation of bungkus, however, is a reference to a wrap, which is what we try to do here each week. At the end of each episode, we like to wrap things up, make them more digestible, or at least containable. Trying to tie up the loose ends on the subject of the TPP is no simple matter, however. There's general agreement that the deal was imperfect, even flawed. Both U.S. presidential contenders found fault with it. Trump lambasted the deal outright, Clinton, well, she hedged and threw the deal under the bus when it became politically untenable not to do so. Now the U.S. is left with precisely nothing. That's right, no deal. Why is this an issue? Because the U.S. no longer dominates world trade. Now, let's consider this for a minute. Trump wanted the U.S. voter to see it differently. The big dog eats first. He's consistently cast the U.S. as the trade power it once was, as opposed to the trade partner it must become. The big dog eats from his own bowl, too, or so this U.S. president would have us believe. But there's no bowls or single servings in the world of global trade. It's a smorgasbord of goods and services. Beef from Australia, rice from Vietnam, poultry from Thailand, and fish from Taiwan. Multilateral trade deals encourage the free flow of goods and services. Bilateral deals, on the other hand, may provide short-term gains around select areas, but they are, by definition, limited. In other words, the big dog analogy is a myth. It no longer exists. My discussion with Oaken and Elms shows just how flawed it is to think of the world in this way. Try as Trump might to have the world think differently, disengagement of any kind is a renunciation of the principles of international trade and the economic benefits that flow from it. Maybe it's time to think less about big dogs and more about butterflies. That's right, butterflies. Students of pop culture and arcane meteorology will recall the famous insight of MIT meteorologist Edward Lorenz, who coined the phrase the butterfly effect. This concept, since the basis of countless sci-fi films, floated the idea that small events can have widespread consequences. The phrase butterfly effect comes from Lorenz's notion that a massive storm might have its roots in the faraway flapping of a butterfly's wings. In effect, the dissolution of the TPP sets in motion the flapping of 1,000 tiny wings. Deb Elms cites a recent article from Politico that shows how pig farmers in Iowa, no longer able to sell to Japan, are the newfound victims of Trump's trade delusions. They are the casualties of short-sighted politics. It's a small detail lost in the preferred narrative of American jobs being shipped off to Asia. Who knew that Iowa's farmers were selling to Japan in the first place? Who even cared? Steve Oaken observes that it's always difficult to tell the story of how everyone benefits from a trade agreement, and a lot easier to hone in on one small group or individual poised to lose. A factory worker in Detroit will lose his job. He has a name. The story of who gains a job or who starts making money for the first time as a result of new trade channels, well, that's more nuanced. It speaks to the possibility of things, the multiplier effect resulting from the interplay of trade and commerce, and the creation of new products and services that flow from it. This too sets off a beating of wings, and depending on one's political persuasion or trade disposition, we can only ask this: is it the sound of the approach of butterflies or locusts? Until next week, this is Steve Stein saying, come in from the outside on Inside Asia.